And also Ms. Robinshane. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honor.
Would you like to reserve any rebuttal time?
Yes, please. 3 minutes, please, Your Honor.
Certainly. Thank you.
Thank you. May it please the Court, I'm Kim Hensley. I'm appellant's counsel, so I'm here on behalf of Mr. Whiting today. May it please the Court, we're here today because Mr. Whiting was convicted of attempted abduction in addition to an assault and battery. He also had a public intoxication, but those are the two main charges that bring us to court today. In this case, the victim was at a fishing pier in Gloucester County, and that's where she had contact with the defendant. And the question before the court...
What was the assault?
I contend that the assault is an assault when, unfortunately, the appellant urinated on the victim. And that was the assault. But that the assault was the entire incident. Because I submit that there was no detention prior to the assault. The Commonwealth argues on brief that there was a detention when Mr. Whiting first touched or had contact with the victim, but that was not the victim's testimony. As the court knows, these cases are all very fact-specific, and so the victim's testimony is dispositive. On the appendix in pages 42 and 43, she refers to what happened, and she says that as she was 6 steps away from the porta potty, the defendant approached her and said something to her, and he reaches out and it's characterized sometimes as a grab, but her left elbow that he, and she says it's not a harsh grab, it wasn't anything, and on cross-examination says he touched her, and so she turned to talk to him and see what he wanted. At that point, she turns, they're at the porta potty, and then he has her right arm, is when he touches her right arm, and she says that she's turning away, and he's helping her turn, and she's at the wall of the porta potty.
Counsel, doesn't he actually, at that point, push her against the porta potty?
She says that he pushes her against, but that he doesn't turn her, that she's the one who's turning away, and that she's then pushed into the porta potty in that turning motion, that he's not spinning her, that he's not directing her into that direction, but that is what occurs. As he has his hand on her, she feels something wet and looks down and sees his penis and sees that he's urinating on her. He has his hand continually on her at that time. If you look to the
appendix, testimony though that she's pushed into the porta potty when she then looks down, in reference, there's no physical contact with the exception of the location where his penis is and the fact that there's urination coming out.
His hand is on her right arm, I believe, at that same time, Your Honor, according to her testimony. She says specifically that she's asked, does he still have his hands on you? It's page 42 onto the top of 43 of the appendix. And he says, and the victim said, no, just because I pushed him away when I noticed it was his penis. So he had his hand on her when she notices his penis is on her and she pushes him away and that breaks all contact with him, and that's when she goes, hits him with the door, goes into the porta potty, locks the door, and that stops any contact between the two of them. So I submit that that contact is all part and parcel of the same incident, of this same assault and battery of her that takes place, as she says, very fast, within seconds. And so in looking at the case law, referring to Hoyt versus Commonwealth and Smith versus Commonwealth, what the court looks at is the four-prong test to see if the detention was incidental to the commission of another crime. The duration of the detention, it's all happening at the same time, and it's all done within a few seconds. The victim said this was a very fast incident, and that initially when he touches her on her left arm, she's turned to talk to him. She says, for whatever reason, she thinks he's going to sell her drugs, but she turns. She says, I can talk my way out of it. She doesn't have any concern at that time.
Let me be sure I understand. Isn't the attempted abduction when the appellant grabbed her and pushed her against the porta potty?
I would say that's how he effectuates the assault and battery of her, and that's part and parcel of the assault and battery, just as in Johnson versus Commonwealth.
Does he even need to touch her? to accomplish that assault?
I believe that, yes, he does have to, or that she's not going to be there for the assault, as in Johnson. In that case, the defendant grabbed the victim from behind and held her so that he could perform a sexual battery against her and rub against her. And so I suspect that in order for the defendant to be able to effectuate the assault, there has to be some detention. In Johnson versus Commonwealth in 1981, the court recognized that assaults are seldom accomplished without some type of detention of the victim. So I don't think that it's realistic to say that the victim's going to stand there and allow the defendant to pull out his penis and urinate her if she's not in some way detained as part and parcel of that same incident. And so I believe that they are together, and that would not constitute a separate direct, although ineffectual, act of attempted abduction for that case. When the court looks at cases where detention has been sufficient to constitute abduction, they're very different from the case at hand before the court today. There are cases like Powell where a defendant orders a victim to move to a more secluded part of her home and she's bound and detained for a long period of time. Or Cardwell where the defendant transported the victim away from a robbery scene after the robbery was complete. In Corum versus Commonwealth, where a victim was dragged 20 feet so that she could be assaulted.
But counsel, you can see that aspiratation is not required. It doesn't have to be in terms of those cases that you've cited.
Yes, ma'am. Aspiratation does not. She can be. The court has to see if this case fulfills the four prongs of what is detention. Is it a separate incident that's occurring, separate and apart from any assault and battery, rather than occurring simultaneously, that this incident is all occurring at the same time, within seconds, and that he has to...
Why couldn't he just urinate on her without touching her?
Well, Your Honor, I would submit it is, as in Johnson, that in order to effectuate, I don't think a victim would stand there to be urinated on. I think that if he did not have a hold of her...
Well, it didn't take very long to accomplish that act.
And it did not in this case, but the force that he needed to detain her to accomplish the act is what occurred. And so I submit that if he had not held her by her right arm, the assault would not have happened. But they happened at the same time, and he had his hand on her as this occurred. I submit to the court that under the Brown Doctrine that the cases follow, that the detention has to be separate and apart from, not merely incidental to. So there is no detention that is separate and apart from the actions that the defendant is doing to the victim during this time at the porta potty.
Counsel.
Yes, ma'am.
I realize you're going through all of the detention elements and talking about Brown, but we're talking about here an attempted detention, which is clearly different from detention.
Yes, ma'am.
And you're not distinguishing... Or can you distinguish that?
Well, Your Honor, I submit that there is no direct ineffectual act that shows that the defendant wanted to detain the victim, that the defendant was acting to assault the victim, and that he did, in fact, assault her. He does not contest that. But that's what these actions were, that any actions, direct or ineffectual, were part and parcel of assaulting the victim.
So you really don't differentiate between attempted detention and actual detention?
There definitely, in the case law, is a distinction when you're looking at the Brown Doctrine, because detention is, as the court said, there doesn't have to be aspiratation, but there is not a specific detention of this victim as found by the circuit court. The circuit court didn't identify any specific direct or ineffectual act that would qualify as such, but did find the appellant guilty of attempted abduction.
Okay, thank you.
So I submit it to the court on the facts on that issue. The second issue that I'd like to address before the court is the revocation hearing, if the court's ready to move on. The appellant had his trial. Unfortunately, he also had a revocation hearing set on the day of sentencing. And the Commonwealth represented to the trial judge at that point, he's already been found in violation. So the judge went on and did a revocation.
The defendant never corrected him, did he?
No, sir. No one in court.
Were there at least two or three occasions where the defendant had an opportunity to say, hold on, Judge, I've never been tried for that? And he never did.
I would say there was one occasion when the revocation hearing occurred. And I'd submit to the court that I was not trial counsel, so I can't, I hate to Monday morning quarterback too much, but neither the judge, the clerk, the Commonwealth, the defense attorney, or the appellant noted in their files or had any information that there had been no revocation hearing. And I submit that that is a problem. The defendant did not say, you know, through trial counsel in any other way, hold on, you know, we haven't done this. However, I believe that under 19.2306C that there must be a hearing in order for the court to have the authority to revoke.
Is that something that could be waived?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. No. Because I think that by doing
that, counsel?
Excuse me?
Do you have any authority that's... I mean, you can waive constitutional rights. Why can't you waive a statutory right?
I think that it can't be waived because the court's order would then become void ab initio because it didn't follow as... Sorry, let me back up and see if I can... The court only has statutory authority to perform a revocation hearing under 19.2-306. And so it has to follow the language of that statute in order to gain the authority to revoke a suspended sentence. And so when it fails to follow the statute that gives it its authority, it renders its orders void, ab initio.
Suppose the defendant said, Judge, I don't want to waste your time or my time with the revocation hearing. Just go on and proceed to sentencing.
Oh, and I think defendants do that all the time. They stipulate to the evidence. I stipulate to the violation. Let's move on. But that's not what happened.
No, but that's a hearing. I'm just saying that the defendant says, I don't even want a hearing.
A defendant may be able to do that, but that's not what occurred in this case. And I submit to the court that in the brief in opposition that was initially filed by the Commonwealth in this case, they conceded that there was error in the circuit court's actions.
Well, when the attorney general isn't bound by the Commonwealth attorney.
I understand, but I'm saying the Commonwealth's attorney who represented to the court that the defendant had already been found in violation conceded error in her brief in opposition. I understand that the attorney general is not bound, but that there was a mistake made in court that day. And so I submit to the court that it renders the order void ab initio, yeah, that it can be attacked. And I submit to the court that even if not, that the ends of justice should apply. This is a grave injustice. The defendant has a 14th Amendment right to limited due process in a revocation hearing and didn't receive any because there was no hearing. So I'll reserve the rest of my time. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Chris Obenchain representing the Commonwealth in this matter. I'd like to begin by pointing out to your honors that what the appellant has just argued is different from what they argued in their brief. And that is the fact that the appellant has just argued that at the same time that Whiting was urinating on the victim, he had his hand on the victim. In the appellant's brief at page 6, the appellant states, when the victim saw appellant's penis on her leg, appellant no longer had his hand on the victim's arm. That was a fact that was uncontested at trial, that he no longer had his hand on the victim's arm at the time that his penis was on her leg and he was urinating on her. That fact is what provides the break in time and action that distinguishes the attempted abduction from the assault and battery. Now, moving back a little bit, I would argue the Commonwealth's position would be that we don't even need to reach the Brown argument because what we have here is not an abduction, but an attempted abduction. And you cannot have a conflict between a detention and a detention plus crime where there's no detention. In an attempted abduction, the detention is by definition ineffectual. And so where you have a conviction for an attempted abduction and a detention plus crime, there's no conflict, as there would be or could be I would say, in an abduction and a detention plus crime. So just starting there, I think the Commonwealth's primary argument, her first argument, would be that, that Brown doesn't apply for those reasons. But even if we look at the Brown doctrine in terms of the facts, I think it also doesn't apply when we look at the facts of this case. And in this case, you know, again, the court has said numerous times that that an individual cannot be convicted of both an abduction and a detention plus crime where the detention involved in the abduction is incidental to or inherent in the detention plus crime. Here, we don't have detention that is incidental to or inherent in the assault and battery. As the court has pointed out, the assault and battery was affected by his putting his penis on her leg and urinating on her. Those were the acts.
Counsel, if I may interrupt for a minute.
Yes,
I think what counsel was indicating in reference to the close proximity of what would be the attempted abduction and the assault, and why the effort for the attempted abduction and the assault were in fact intertwined or the same, was that it wouldn't have been accomplished but for the fact that he had to grab her in order to be able to effect the assault. Do you want to speak to that?
Yes, Your Honor, I will, because the court has said previously that even if the detention makes it easier to accomplish the detention plus crime, that in and of itself does not create a conflict under Brown, and that's what we have here. The acts that constituted the assault and battery were Mr. Whiting urinating on the victim. He didn't need to grab her arm or, you know, detain her in any way in order to accomplish that. If the facts, you know, if we change the facts a little bit and if he had walked up behind her and she didn't know he was there and he urinated on her, he still would have been, could have been convicted of assault and battery. So he didn't need to grab her arm in order to accomplish the assault and battery. The assault and battery was him, you know, his penis on her leg and him urinating on her. So even though his grabbing her arm may have made that easier to accomplish, that in and of itself doesn't create a conflict under Brown. As I mentioned, we have a break in time and in action from the first part, as the Commonwealth argued below, the first part where he walks up to her, he grabs her, says, "I have something to show you." She turns around, gets pushed up against the porta potty, but she's able to escape his grasp. And that's where we have an ineffectual act. He's not able to, you know, detain her. She's able to escape his grasp, but then immediately after that, his penis is on her, he urinates on her, and those are the actions that constituted the assault and battery. So even I would concede, obviously, this is a different case, and because of the facts that they happened one right after the other, it's a little bit different from other cases where perhaps someone may have transported someone from one room to another or something of that nature. But the mere fact that they are very closely connected in time is not the distinguishing factor. The distinguishing factor is the detention inherent in the detention plus crime. And I would point the court particularly to Hoyt, the Hoyt case, because that is the one case where this court has overturned an abduction under the Brown doctrine. And in that case, you had an individual committing a robbery, and during the course of the robbery, uses their firearm to, you know, move people to another part of the store. And this court said, you know, because those actions happened while the robbery was taking place, then it wasn't distinguishable under Brown, and the abduction was reversed. That's not what we have here. It's not what happened. The actions that constituted the attempted abduction were not happening while the actions that constituted the assault were taking place. They were prior to. And in every case where the actions constituting the abduction are prior to the actions constituting the detention plus crime, Smith, Pryor, Hoke, and a recent case, Epps, all of those cases, Brown did not apply. And so even if we, you know, get past the fact of this being an attempted abduction as opposed to an abduction, even if, you know, we're looking at whether there's a conflict under Brown, I think these facts, and certainly, you know, it was never contested, it was never disputed at trial that he no longer had a hold of her arm at the point in time that he was urinating on her. And given those facts established in the record, the trial court could rely on that fact in reaching the conclusion that these were separate and distinct crimes. With respect to the second assignment of error, I think just very briefly, we cited the Recio case, and in that case, the court stated that it's beyond question the court that has ordered the suspension of a sentence has the power to revoke it when a defendant fails to comply with the court's order. So,
But they don't have the authority to revoke if there's not been a hearing to determine whether he violated the terms.
Well, my response to that, Your Honor, would be that is waivable because a suspension of sentence and a probation revocation is a creature of statute. And we cited other cases, Rawls in particular, that indicated that talked about that an indictment can be waived because an indictment is a creature
of
statute.
Doesn't the case law say that a waiver has to be made intelligently with full understanding of all the facts?
Well, Your Honor, I don't know if that's been applied to situations such as this, but I think the argument here is that Whiting was denied his due process because he wasn't granted a hearing. And I think if we look at what occurred, he was present in court. He had an opportunity to be heard. He had an opportunity to present evidence on his behalf. He had an opportunity to call witnesses on his behalf. And certainly, you know, probation revocations, the defendant's not entitled to all the same protections as in a criminal trial, but...
He's entitled to procedural due process.
Yes, Your Honor, and the Commonwealth would argue that that he received procedural due process because he had a court hearing, everybody showed up, nobody disputed the statement of the Commonwealth's attorney, and I agree that that was a mistake. I mean, that a mistake did happen, but not every mistake is a denial of due process. And in this type of situation, you have, you know, his statutory right to a hearing could be waived, and I would argue was waived because nobody objected to the finding by the trial court that he had already violated his probation, and particularly under these facts, where the same trial court that had already found him guilty of other offenses, which would have been the basis for the probation revocation, would have been the one hearing, you know, the revocation hearing. There was no denial of due process, and he, you know, had an opportunity to present all of those matters that he would have presented to the trial court, and as a result, we would argue that his right to a hearing under the statute was waived. The order is not void ab initio because the trial court obviously had the power to do what it did, which is revoke his probation and give him the sentence that it gave him. Those things were not outside of the trial court's ability to do, and so that doesn't, because of that, not only is the order not void, but the ends of justice exception would not apply in this case. Unless the court has any further questions, we'll rely for the remainder on our brief.
Thank you, Ms. Robinshain. ahead, Ms. Hensley.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, I just would like to point out to the court, again, and if I stated it incorrectly on brief, the court has the appendix. I know you're familiar with the case, that you reviewed everything. But the victim clearly says that the defendant still had his hands on her, and she pushed him away when she noticed his penis was on her, so that those things happened simultaneously. And so the record does reflect that, and that's what the Commonwealth's victim testified to at the hearing. I would submit to the court, again, that I believe the circuit court's order was void ab initio, because the only authority it has to revoke is under 19.2-306. And in order to have that authority, it has to follow the statutory requirements that there be a hearing. And without a hearing, the circuit court no longer can exercise the authority, that statutory authority, because it hasn't fully exercised all the requirements made on it by the statute from the legislature.
We've discussed this earlier.
Yes, sir.
Circuit court clearly has subject matter jurisdiction to address probation violations, right?
It does, yes, sir.
So if we get subject matter jurisdiction out of the way, then what's left?
I would submit that it does not have the authority to do it because of the for a variety of reasons, that the court does have authority under 19.2-306 to do revocations. It gives it that authority.
We're talking about not subject matter jurisdiction, but potential jurisdiction.
I think the court loses jurisdiction when it doesn't act according to the requirements placed on it by law. And I would submit to the court that since this was a mistake, that it was a grave injustice to the defendant, and that it would call into play the ends of justice exception under 5A18, because he did not have the opportunity to challenge any evidence against him. There was a sentencing hearing, but that's a completely different thing than an evidentiary hearing to find out whether or not there's been a violation.
But counsel, so, these were offenses that were the basis of the revocation that were before the trial court. So doesn't that sort of undercut your argument?
And that does happen a lot in circuit court, that the court will automatically move into. But I don't think it does, Your Honor, because it starts a completely separate hearing. And so the court can't just say, well, I was in court 2 weeks ago and I heard something about this defendant, so I'm revoking him today. That the court and that our circuit court judges have prior knowledge because of cases they've sat on about defendants or issues that may come before them doesn't mean that they can automatically apply that prior knowledge to this case.
But so he had the judicial notice of its own order, and presumably there would be a conviction order first, and then the sentencing order obviously would come later where the revocation hearing would come.
The court can, but Your Honor, I've only seen that done when a party asks the court to take judicial notice of its orders in order to prove a point in court or present evidence in court. The court on revocation and evidentiary matters, I've never seen the court do it sua sponte, that I have this knowledge and I'm just going to apply it to a case. That puts the court in the position of a party rather than the neutral arbiter of what's happening in the courtroom, because they're relying on information that they have in order to take actions that no party has asked them to take. And so I don't think that would be correct. Thank you. My time has expired.
Thank you
very much, Your Honors.
We'll come down and greet
counsel,
and please remember to sign the sheets down there. Thank you.